Wing's current supporters include your community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose website gifteconomy.com has videos of all plenaries from the World Women's Congress for a Healthy Planet. She hosts new videos at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Old Wing sound logo you heard in this show was created by Maggie Payne. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
What you've been listening to here on CKT 90.3 FM is a radio documentary that was created by a Canadian radio show, Wings, with host Frieda Werden. And it covers the Women's Agenda to Save the Planet, which happened 30 years ago. It offers a glimpse into history and the climate action that was happening that long ago, and as well as some insights into our current climate crisis, even though we are living in a very different time, of course, with the internet, with social media. But we're still facing similar institutional and psychological barriers. So thank you for listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. This is In the Motherhood. Thank you to Wings for letting us borrow this content. And if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email inthemotherhood@ckut.ca. Thanks for listening and have a great night.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Amandla, your weekly broadcast from Doug Miller and Gwen Schulman here at CKUT 90.3 FM. We try to bring you news and analysis from the continent of Africa that you will not get elsewhere. And I think tonight is very representative of that night, that kind of news. Gwen, what have you got on the go?
Yeah, it's going to be a great show. We were invited to attend by Zoom a presentation of a book that recently came out in South Africa called Amakomiti, Grassroots Democracy in Southern African Shack Settlements by Trevor Ngwane. I will tell you more about who he is in a few minutes. But anyway, suffice it to say, it's a book that really looks at the stubborn legacy of apartheid as it's reflected in disparities of wealth, in particular housing, the housing situation, and the role that shack dwellers continue to play as some of the leaders in the struggle for transformative change in South Africa. Fascinating book, fascinating discussion. A group of three people kind of walk us through, and I was able to listen in. And so tonight we'll be playing some excerpts from that discussion.
Well, and I'm going to talk very briefly about the antithesis of democracy, a real democracy, and that is the death of F.W. de Klerk, not bemoaned by my part at all. So we'll just tie that all together on Amandla. Stay tuned.
No rights. Where can they run to? 'Cause they
Welcome back to Amandla here on CKUT 90.3 FM, CKUT.ca around the world. So a couple of days ago, the Institute for African Alternatives, and along with Surplus Radical Books in South Africa, held a discussion of the book Amakomiti, Grassroots Democracy in Southern African Shack Settlements, written by Trevor Ngwane, who's a founding member of the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee, a scholar activist, and a senior lecturer in the sociology department at the University of Johannesburg. The session was moderated by Coney Benson, who's a longstanding friend of us here at Amandla. She's a historian, organizer, and educator, and a lecturer in the history department at the University of Western Cape. She's also the author of the graphic history Crossroads, I Live Where I Like, which Doug and I will be reviewing with Coney in an upcoming show. We still need to get the dates sorted out, but it's a beautiful book and it'll be a lot of fun to talk about. Also present as a discussant was Bevel Lucas, who is a trade unionist, anti-eviction activist in Cape Town, and is an occupier of the Sissy Goal House, an unused government hospital that is now home to some 1,000 occupiers. We were invited to attend this presentation, and today we're going to bring you a few thoughts from all three participants on the book and on the potential that shack dweller movements have for building democracy from the bottom up and democratizing the economy. So Coney opened the presentation with a brief reading from the book that does a good job at setting up the tone and the content.
Life in the informal settlements is not easy. There are many challenges. Nonetheless, we have seen that those who live there have no choice but to rise up to the challenge and take action to make a life. They learn to do things for themselves, including creating new housing developments, drawing up town planning schemes, and turning open spaces into places people can call home. In this book, I have focused on how they organize themselves into committees and assemblies, general meetings, mass meetings, in order to find collective solutions in the struggle to satisfy their needs. Can we learn anything from this practice? Can people who live in shanty towns, shacks, and favelas teach us anything about democracy, about how to govern society in a way that is inclusive, participatory, and addresses popular needs?
Coney asked Trevor to briefly summarize the book and his key takeaway from his research. Here's Trevor Ngwane.
You know, when I found out about the existence of all these committees in the various informal settlements which I visited, so I visited, I'm sure, more than 100 informal settlements in four provinces, but I report on 47 informal settlements. And out of that 47, 46 had committees. And then I found that every settlement would have at least one committee, sometimes more than one. Big settlements, you can get as many as six, seven, eight, a battery of committees, some of them working in concert, others, of course, you know, of different types and focuses. And this gave me the idea that there is a level of self-organization happening in the shack settlements, which perhaps many people don't know much about. And of course, there is a stigma about shack settlements, which we inherited from apartheid. Remember, the apartheid regime did not like shack settlements. They called it squatter camps, places to be bulldozed and removed, flattened. Remember, because there was the influx control, so they wanted total control of the movement of the working class in the urban areas. So I thought maybe to reflect on this level, high level of self-organization would restore the agency, you know, of the shack dwellers in the eyes of many people, and also point out to a form of democratic process happening, so to speak, below the radar, which we should pay attention to.
Coney asked Bebel Lucas to talk about how leadership emerged and has changed over time at Sissy Goldhouse Occupation and the work of the committees and occupiers in establishing the social order there.
I must say that when the comrades from Rajova visited us in Cape Town and in other parts of South Africa, in a sort of a informal discussion with them, we were talking about how we build democracy in the occupation. And the one thing that struck me was the comment of, if you want to build democracy, you're going to have meetings, 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 and meetings. So I think in many ways, that notion of bringing people together to have the opportunity to engage with different aspects of their lives in the occupation reflects that. What we've done in our occupation, because it's quite an expensive occupation of more than 1,000 people living here, so that's about 400 household families, and we are in about 7 sections. So each section has its own leadership that is elected by that section, and together with the leadership and the people living in that section, they engage around the daily issues within that section. So we have quite a bit of a crazy setup in that we have a Monday night leadership meeting, we have a Tuesday night monitors meeting, we have a Wednesday night sectional meetings, we have a Thursday probably mess house meetings, and on a Friday evening we have the disciplinary committees, and over the weekends we have education. So living in the occupation is literally living your struggle and living your democracy. Of course, whilst all those structures are there, it's not so smooth sailing. It's a real challenge of how to consistently engage with them. Bear in mind that many of the people that are engaged in the occupation are people that have come into activism post-apartheid. So you essentially have to propose organization, you have to propose activity, but you also have to extract volunteerism out of them and create the space in which many of them that are not elected into leadership position are able to participate in the life of the occupation at a voluntary level. And out of that, you can see how people's consciousness are developed, how people's commitment changes, and how the life of AMA committee, AMA meetings becomes part of a way of life. But a way of life in the sense that they enjoy the fruits of their labor. For example, when we were able to negotiate with the municipality about basic services, stuff like refuse collection, stuff like electricity, water supply, sewage reconnection. So these were all the spaces that people had engaged in and had determined how best they could reconnect those services. And by the time we were able to enter into some kind of discussion with the municipality, and bear in mind, Cape Town, the city of Cape Town, is not your most friendly municipality on the earth. In actual fact, it's the most right-wing municipality that we have in the country. And so we were able to engage with them, knowing fully that we have backup, we have support of the occupiers, we are strong enough as a leadership to engage with them. So it's a way of life in the occupation, how we create the space for democratic practice and how we try to hold on to it, which in itself is a challenge, in that there are, we have comrades from different political persuasions. And so we have to try and create the opportunities for people to put their positions, to engage in a discussion, and to arrive at a position that is acceptable, and then we proceed with whatever has been decided upon. So we have various volunteer committees for food production, for gardening, for after school homework and support, for art in terms of writing, drawing. So there's a wide range of activities that we've created. So the different layers of leadership is what affords them the opportunity to get into a culture of discussion, a culture of decision-making, and ultimately a sense of ownership of whatever conclusion or decisions people have arrived at and how best to implement those decisions that have been formulated on a collective basis. And I really think the way you have approached how people formulate their committees, how they structure their committees, how they strengthen their committees is a real way of teaching those of us who are not engaged with this type of practice on a daily basis of what is the real possibility, what is the possibility of realizing a culture of democracy and accountability for elected leadership or even for volunteers in that matter, so that people know that, that I've arrived in a position as a result of my contribution and as a result of the recognition that people have seen what I'm able to contribute as an individual, but within the collective.
In the next excerpt, we're going to play Coney, Trevor, and Bevel discuss what can be learned from democracy on the margins. In other words, the kinds of politics the marginalized in shack settlements are engaging in that are potentially transformative in a post-apartheid South Africa, where the legacy of racialized dispossession is still largely intact.
Yes, this is an important point, because remember, shack settlements, you know, are more or less located on the margins, geographic margins of society. So people find, you know, a piece of land, occupy it, take it over. Often they take over, you know, what you can call marginal land, land which lies disused. Sometimes, you know, a land which is basically dangerous, because it could be near a dump site, it could be below the flood line. And in any case, many people who live in the shack settlements are themselves slightly marginalized by society, because, you know, some will be unemployed, some, if they are employed, will be precariously employed. So they don't participate fully, you know, in the political and social processes of society. Now, I thought perhaps the kind of democratic practice which Comrade Lucas has just described, you know, can be termed democracy on the margins. But the point of that is to argue that such democracy should, as you know, the youth say now in their theories, should be centered, is the kind of democracy which societies need today, at a time when, for example, we've just had the local elections and everyone is complaining that few people actually voted. So there is a sense that, you know, these democratic practices, which we don't pay attention to, might be the way to go. They must be removed from the margin and brought to the center.
Thank you. I appreciate that comment about where, you know, what is marginal and what needs to be recentered. And I, you know, this democracy on the margins is clearly central within these committees. And these committees are where the majority of people are living, in informal settlements, you know, across South Africa and across the global South. We know that since 2005, the majority of people in the world live in urban areas, and the majority of those people live in informality. And I really appreciated how you spoke about the different ways that informal settlements are started. Some by what you referred to as slow encroachment, and some by occupation. And it reminds me of what the Panthers always said, that you only get what you're organized for. to take. And so in the book, you ask the question, or you posit, I want to ask you, to what extent do occupations disrupt private land ownership in South Africa? It's one of the key claims. And to what extent is this one of our best prospects for redistribution? And I think I'll actually start with Bevel in terms of you living in an occupation. But what is your sense around organization and land and housing redistribution through occupation at this moment in time?
Yeah, I think we need to context the occupations and land occupations for use value, which is very different to the capitalistic approach of land for profit. And the slogan that the RTC uses, land for people, not for profit, is quite significant in how the occupation movement engages with the land occupation and property occupations. We've been engaged in property occupations, but one of the activities that we engaged in was to move onto site, on a site called Site B, that was owned and sold to a company called Growth Point by the city of Cape Town, that was discounted to the tune of 148 million. But it's even worse than that. It's the makeup of the shareholding of this company, Growth Point. The biggest shareholder in Growth Point is the labor movement, organized trade unions, that have the highest shareholding percentage in Growth Point. And that is the most disarming aspect of private property. And it even gets worse than that. In an area called Sea Point here in Cape Town, SACTU, the Clothing Workers Trade Union, is involved in development of private property, and not a single member of the trade union is able to afford to live in any of these apartments. So to understand the question of land and housing is to understand the use value of it, and also the ownership in it too. And what we've tried to do here in our occupation is to say that this occupation is about collective development of the site and not privatized and individual owned property on the site. We have now been able to get the municipality in talks around the future development. And essentially, we are arguing for mixed use development. So it's not only social housing development on the site, but also for low income groups that do not make the threshold for social housing. But for those that are not able to meet the threshold, they too should be accommodated on the site. And it's been engaging with the different aspects of social housing with the municipality. So we really think that the manner in which we begin to argue around land and around property, it should be located within the context of use value rather than for individual or private ownership.
Coney went on to ask Trevor to talk about the extent to which occupiers can disrupt private land ownership, their potential to achieve redistribution from below.
Private property is the basis for exploitation and oppression. So someone or a group of people, a class of people, the capitalists, they take over pieces of land and call those lands theirs. And then they start charging rent, they start developing them. They use the land basically to make money. Now, what Comrade Lucas is talking about is the use value. So the land should be used not to make a few people rich, but it should be used to benefit, you know, other members of society. So by definition, you know, those who are homeless, those who have no proper shelter are in a way dispossessed. They don't have access to available land, to available property, to available houses. So you'll find that in Cape Town, for example, there's a lot of houses, but there are people sleeping under the bridge. Those people, I view them as people who are dispossessed, who are not able to access proper, decent shelter. So the Occupy movement, what Comrade Beville is doing with his comrades, taking over land, you know, building homes, building shelter, you know, is part of the struggle against not only homelessness, but the monopolization of pieces of land by few people who are only interested in making profit. So the shack settlement movement, the Occupy movement, I think, you know, is the key towards what I can call economic democratization.
In the last segment that we're going to play tonight, Coney invites Bevel and Trevor to reflect on the political potential of occupation movements, their potential for reform or indeed transformation. Here's Coney setting up the conversation.
In the book, you also, you kind of weave in the debates about social movements as potentially reformist or transformative in the kind of scholarship and writing, but also in the practice within movements. And I know, Bevel, you and I have had many conversations over the last years, and this resonates in the book that Trevor has written, the kind of tensions between wanting a place you call your own and the very quick parceling out of land. And I know the city of Cape Town over years will often use the argument that, you know, individual tenure is not the answer to collective ownership. And at the same time, it's often used as an excuse. And so I'm curious to hear from both of you about those debates in the, we can broadly call those debates on the left. How do they sort of square up about as compared to the actual situation on the ground or within occupations? Because I think the book does well to dispute this idea that there's the thinkers and the analysts and the scholars, and then there's masses of people putting up, you know, shacks on open pieces of land. So as two people who have really spent time in those spaces and having those debates, how would you kind of describe the takeaways or learnings in terms of what an occupation can potentially do or not do?
Hi, can I go first before Trevor? I think the learnings that we've certainly had within the occupation in Sisigual House is by creating opportunity for people to participate in the various activities that strengthens the community, that strengthens various committees, is central to understanding this question or this notion of use value and how displaced people come together to engage with what is the future like, what should the future be like, and how do they engage themselves in trying to grapple with this notion of collective ownership as opposed to individual ownership. And so in many of the discussions, we've had to help people to understand the idea of use value, the idea of collective ownership, the possibilities of cooperative type of ownership, and why property power per se, as we have experienced here in Cape Town, presents a real threat to the possibility of en masse social housing. So socializing not on the terms of how the current legislative framework frames it, but social housing as we understand social housing on the basis of decent housing for all, and not just a selective few based on income. And we are beginning to engage with the authorities around this question of mixed social housing and how we believe that that presents a real opportunity to begin to make inroads into this notion of property power that is then strengthened by legislation and is used by different arms of the state to lay claim to the notion that there's no land available, that it would be too costly, that the best option that we can expect is to have some kind of tokenism or some elements of a house, and you then must now take that further. Well, our argument, very frankly, is that that's a whole lot of bull. There is enough capital and resources, both infrastructure as well as human resources, available to address and to perhaps make a significant inroad in delivering what we will refer to as social housing across the income sectors for the poor.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there is no doubt in my mind that there is enough cement, bricks, you know, to build houses for everyone. So the real problem is private property, private ownership, and the idea which Comrade Beville is questioning, the idea that people should make money, a profit from, you know, a house. Okay, so this is the key. So the whole issue of the property market is about, you know, a group of people, a social class, you know, business people, big business, trying to make money from, you know, a good, a service which everyone needs. So the only way that you can have houses for all, for that matter, healthcare for all, decent education for all, is if we remove this profit motive. So we have to start somewhere. You know, I would say that for all basic services, water, electricity, housing, healthcare, indeed, maybe even roads, we should remove altogether the profit motive. But to do that means a direct challenge, attack, elimination of private property. So the matter is like that, and it stands like that. And I would say it's at the heart of the class struggle. So now I heard Comrade Lucas saying, you know, some trade unionists are now owning property. Basically, what has happened, they've bought in into the capitalist ideology of private property. So in a way, they are not realizing their own power to do away with a system which oppresses them as workers, them as the working class, you know, and other people. So I think that we have to directly challenge private property, directly challenge the making of profit from the provision of basic necessities.
So that wraps it up for our discussion of the book. Their discussion was a little bit longer, but I think that you probably get the essence of the book, really, obviously, completely fascinating and inspiring. So the name of the book, again, is Amakomiti, Grassroots Democracy in Southern African Shack Settlements, and the author is Trevor Nganwe. And a big thank you to Kony Benson for having invited us to sit in on what I said was an elucidating and inspiring presentation.
Someone yell, Please don't bother your soul trying to understand that philosophy. It's all about hypocrisy. So don't bother your soul trying to buy into their fashion. They'll only take away your passion. Please don't bother your soul. Don't you see, don't you see, don't you see, don't you see? The system is a joke. All they feed us is coke. Yeah. The system is a joke. All they feed us is coke. Yeah. The system is a joke. All they feed us is coke. Yeah, the system is a joke. All they feed us is cold. Please don't bother your soul trying to understand their philosophy. It's all about hypocrisy. Please don't bother your soul now trying to buy into their fashion. They'll only take away your passion. So don't bother your soul now playing the game. They'll only fuck with your name. Don't you see, don't you see, don't you see, don't you see? The system is a joke. All they feed us is coke. The system is a joke. All they feed us is coke. The system is a joke. All they feed us is coke.
Despite an unqualified apology for the ills of apartheid, many South Africans have mixed feelings about F.W. de Klerk. In the wake of his death, the F.W. de Klerk Foundation has released a pre-recorded video, his last message to the nation. He's credited with dismantling apartheid and bringing about reforms that included the release of political prisoners such as Nelson Mandela and the unbanning of political organizations like the ANC and the PAC. His speech at the opening of the 1990 session of Parliament marked the official end of segregation policies and the official start of the negotiations that led to a constitutional democracy. Now, Executive Director of the F.W. de Klerk Foundation, Dave Stewart, PAC President Mzwanele Nyonzo, and former anti-apartheid activist Father Michael Lepsley are joining us now live from the Mother City just to talk to us as we reflect on de Klerk's legacy. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Mr. Stewart, if I may start with you. By now, you've heard a number of reactions since yesterday's passing of Mr. de Klerk. What's your sense where the country is at in recognizing Mr. de Klerk's role in South Africa during apartheid and in the transition of democracy? Just to kick off this discussion, what's your sense today?
Well, my sense is that that South Africa is divided on the legacy of F.W. de Klerk, as it is divided on so many other questions. However one may look at the situation from one's preferences or dislikes, the fact remained that F.W. de Klerk led the process that moved South Africa from apartheid to constitutional democracy. And it was a very difficult process. So you have the record that, as with all political figures, you're going to have widely differing views regarding the motives, the merits involved in the actions of the man.
Yeah, former President Kgalema Motlanthe telling my colleague Puleli Tshweti-Jones earlier today in Pretoria that in his view, F.W. de Klerk stepped forward at a time when it was really difficult to facilitate that transition. I don't know whether or not Mr. Nyonso, the PAC, would agree with that.
Definitely, I won't agree. I won't agree with that. We don't share that sentiment. That de Klerk occupied a special place in South Africans' heart is not true. He occupies that special place in Kgalema Motlanthe's heart. He must not speak on behalf of South Africans. We have scars from de Klerk. De Klerk has got blood in his hands. He killed innocent kids in Umtata in 1995. He killed so many families. The families, the Calata families, Craydock 4, they want answers. De Klerk never came up. He never went to the Truth Commission and being interrogated for what he did. So many people were killed under his own watch, even after the so-called unbanning of political parties. People were killed. 1993 was 3 years after the killing of, after the opening of political parties. So we disagree.
So you still hold him responsible for that period of transition where we saw that violence you're mentioning in the early 90s and the emergence of the so-called third force?
Not only in that period, when he served in the government, when he was in cabinet in the 70s, in the 80s, when he killed people in Moi Patong, so many people were killed under de Klerk, and he never apologized. At some point, he even
but
said...
But he has he now, but he has recently apologized. He has issued
what is
an
recently?
Unqualified apology.
What is recently? Why the foundation had to wait until he died and then release a pre-recorded video? The apology, even in that circus that was called Truth Commission, people were interrogated. You had to tell them, what did you do? How did you do it? Why did you do it? And then they would consider to forgive you. He was never interrogated anywhere. We opened the case against him. We wanted him to go to court and answer for his sins. Families that did never get closure. People died, just perished. Pinzi Zaba was killed in Nanda in KZN in 1991. And his throat was slit after being killed under de Klerk. Where did de Klerk ever go and apologize? Why the foundation waited until de Klerk died
and then released
a video?
Yeah, I'll allow Mr. Stewart to respond to that a little bit later on, but I need to bring in Father Michael Lapsley first. Mr. Stewart, I'll give you an opportunity to respond to why did you wait until now, the question that Mr. Nyonso is asking to release that apology video. Father Michael Lapsley, as far as I recall, thank you very much for joining us. You were a direct victim of a bomb that was sent to you in 1990, I think, in April or thereabouts, if my memory serves me well. You've had your chance. I saw a little bit of a clip from you talking to one of my colleagues at ENCA yesterday, but we thought we should bring you in as part of this conversation as well today. 24 hours later, you reflecting on what you are just hearing now from Mr. Stewart and Mr. Nyonso, and with your experience way back in 1990, how do you feel about F.W. de Klerk's legacy currently?
Well, thank you. I want to firstly express my condolences to Dave, obviously a lifelong colleague of F.W., as well as to his family and all the people in the foundation. I think it is problematic to speak from the grave when there can be no rejoinder to that. In my case, as you said, I received the letter bomb in April of 1990, 3 months after the release of Nelson Mandela. When I gave evidence to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, I said that I held F.W. politically and morally responsible for my bombing. The reason was that I was attempted assassination by a death squad within the machinery of the apartheid state, of which de Klerk was the president. Now, he says, I saw nothing, I knew nothing, I did nothing. Now, the late Van Zyl Slabbert said to me, I went to FW, I spoke to him about the despots, and FW chose to do nothing to disband those despots, which is why I say he has political and moral responsibility for what happened to me. But also for my comrade from the PAC, it is in that period of him receiving the Nobel Peace Prize that there were the killing of the children that he referred to in Umtata. And also, there has never been any reckoning. There's never been an account of the role that FW played as the head of the State Security Council, at which decisions were made. I don't know whether Dave himself was a member of that State Security Council, and which decisions were made to kill people, to kill activists, like the Cradock Four. So when I first heard about de Klerk's death, I immediately thought of Lukanya, of the Cradock Four, and of other people who were still waiting for accountability. And then partly, of course, that also raises the question, was there a deal between de Klerk and our democratic government on not going ahead with prosecutions, which should have gone ahead and were recommended by the TRC?
Okay.
And maybe Dave can tell us whether he was party to those behind-the-scenes deal that have meant there has been no accountability for the killings on the watch of FW. And of course, he makes an apology, but there's nothing. He's always ducked the question of the scale of killings, the scale of torture. He often spoke of bad apples. And of course, it's not long ago that he said it's not true that apartheid was a crime against humanity. And I believe Dave is the speechwriter. So presumably, Dave wrote that speech in which de Klerk said that apartheid was not a crime against humanity.
There are a number of points, Dave, that Mr. Stewart, that have been put to you by Father Lapsley and as well as Mr. Nyons. I mean, there's a lot of stuff to cover. Of course, you started by saying
where does one begin with all of this? The Truth and Reconciliation Commission had at its disposal all of the documentation from the State Security Council, from witnesses, from testimonies relating to illegal actions taken by the former government. They could find nothing, absolutely nothing, to link F.W. de Klerk to any decision to perpetrate a crime against humanity or a gross violation of human rights. So the Truth and Reconciliation Commission had all of that at its disposal, but it did not succeed in finding anything to
what was to, there a deal? What was there a deal? Sorry, Mr. Stewart. Was there a deal?
I'm trying to answer the questions now. I'll come to that. There was nothing that was found by the TRC to associate de Klerk with any kind of violation of gross violation of human rights. In fact, Archbishop Tutu's biographer, John Allen, wrote in his biography of Archbishop Tutu, called The Rabble Rouser for Peace, he said that the findings of the TRC relating to de Klerk were embarrassing in their paucity and their inability to link him to anything of this kind. So the TRC, with all of these resources at its disposal, could not find this because it did not exist. As for de Klerk's record in terms of the security forces and the ghastly attack on Reverend, on our co-panelists here, it was nothing to do with what de Klerk was all about. One of the first things he did when he took over as president was to gather the officer corps of the police and the military in separate meetings, at which he told them, the war, the struggle is over. Your job is now simply to defend the country and to maintain law and order. But there were elements within the security forces that were clearly acting against his orders and his instructions.
But he was the political head. But he was the political head.
Wait a second. There were elements on all sides that wanted to destroy the negotiation process. On the far right, they wanted to have violence, and they wanted to have mayhem and bloodshed. So they were working absolutely against de Klerk's policy of changing South Africa and beginning negotiations. Why should de Klerk, on the one hand, risk his political career to launch negotiations to unban the SACP and the PAC and the ANC, to release Nelson Mandela, if his objective at the same time is to carry on with an underhand war? It's just simply not true.
Okay, Mr. Stewart, we're going to just take a quick break. We'll continue this discussion. The point is, somebody has to take accountability. He was the political head. He's the head of state. There's this big machinery that's been set up by the apartheid government, of which he was a head for quite some time. Yes, he's now wanting to embrace change and the transition, but people are still dying. That's what we're hearing now. But then it's a very interesting time that somebody who got the Nobel Peace Prize is still being viewed very, very, very suspiciously in terms of his intentions at the time. But we'll continue to talk about that. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Just stay connected. This is, of course, The Lead on ENCA.
Dear listeners, the subject matter this week provides an amazing contrast with Trevor and Gwani embracing the marginalized and downtrodden who live in the shack settlements of South Africa, embraces them as the linchpin for real democracy. And in the meantime, the newspapers and the political elites eulogizing the death of South Africa's last white president. He was really the antithesis of real democracy, and everything that he represented was anti-democratic in the extreme. F.W. de Klerk died on November 11th last week, Remembrance Day. Many tributes poured in for the last white president of South Africa and what he did to bring about democratic rule by the majority of the people, all the people of South Africa. I, however, am unable to say anything good about him and the hellish system of racism that he and his people applied, developed, and misused for over 50 years to exploit the people of South Africa and the country they live in. You heard the comments by the people from South Africa, the F.W. de Klerk Foundation, the PAC leader, and Father Lapsley in the broadcast from ENC, the news network from South Africa, and it represents and is indicative of the split in South Africa. And I just want to bring about a little bit of historical background that I think helped frame all this. First, F.W. de Klerk was born in 1936 at the height of Nazi power in Europe. The Afrikaner people of South Africa that he was born into openly admired Hitler. They wore Nazi tattoos and cheered the way Hitler stood up to the English. They identified wholly with the Nazi policy of Aryan racial superiority. For the other parts of how I feel, I found the op-ed article written by Richard Poplack in the Globe and Mail just 2 days ago really quite insightful and representative of much of what I think. Just to point out that Richard Poplack is an editor of the Daily Maverick, South Africa's most critical news source, and co-produced the documentary film on Timothy Bell called Influence that we in Amandla reviewed when it first appeared in 2019. And Richard Poplack goes on to say that the list of Nobel Peace Prize laureates includes some ghoulish recipients, not a few of whom subsequently used their prize as a bloody cudgel. So the weird one that he points out is that F.W. de Klerk co-won the award with Nelson Mandela. He won the Peace Prize. And Poplack is questioning, how can you talk about peace? What do you mean by peace exactly? He goes on to say that de Klerk passed away this week at the age of 85. He grew up in the eye of the system. His father was one of the architects of institutional apartheid, having served as a well-known National Party minister in successive cabinets. A lawyer by training, F.W. first entered the all-white House of Assembly in 1972 and never looked back. He was the young, hawkish face of the National Party, a weapons-grade debater who served, just like his old man, in successive ministerial roles. Even if we were to employ the loosest term, interpretation of the term liberal, Mr. de Klerk never came close, nor was he a reformer. He served the apartheid regime as an apartheid devotee, helping to craft, calibrate, and occasionally soften its policies, usually just for optical purposes. He was an unabashed Afrikaner supremacist, a virulent anti-communist, and conservative about pretty much everything else. But he was also a pragmatist, entranced by the laissez-faire neoliberalism promulgated by Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, both of whom later became ardent de Klerkian admirers. When de Klerk became president in 1989, he had one choice. South Africa was broke and broken. Apartheid was in triage, medical triage. It was a time to midwife a new dispensation into being. After he freed Mr. Mandela, unbanned the ANC, and terminated institutional segregation, far too much was made of Mr. de Klerk's moral fortitude. Far too little was made of his brilliance as a political strategist. Lesser intellects in his cabinet wailed as institutional white supremacy was dismantled around them. Shadowy forces lurked to the government, stoked black-on-black violence, creating a volatile and bloody stage for the theater of transition. But, as Richard Poplack goes on to say, how much Mr. de Klerk knew of the Civil War's architecture is still in dispute. Nonetheless, at least 10,000 people died over the course of his five-year presidency. Ultimately, Mr. de Klerk wanted was a hand in negotiating the Constitution, the final draft of which was to be written by those in power following the first free elections in April. And he managed to manipulate his party into 20% of the national vote for that first election, and that thus giving the white population a say over the final constitutional, most notably the rights that would bar economic redress or reparations for black South Africans. Mr. de Klerk had won, but he wasn't a sportsman about it. He never acknowledged the National Party's brutality, nor did he fully, that's his word, agree with the United Nations designation of apartheid as a crime against humanity. He served as a truculent presence beside Mr. Mandela as one of his two deputy ministers, presidents rather, and vacated that office in a huff in 1996. As for the atrocities committed during his tenure, he always remained tight-lipped. He had a chance during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission process to come clean, to provide at least some succor to the victims of the regime he helped run. He refused. Just before he died, he recorded a video that provides something of a posthumous apology, but it plays like a legacy protecting provisionism, a real de Klerkian specialty. He's taken many secrets and a Nobel Peace Prize to the grave. Hopefully both prove more useful in the afterlife. This is the op-ed article that appeared in the Globe and Mail 2 days ago from Richard Poplack, an editor of Daily Maverick magazine in South Africa. He's a Canadian himself, and I agree with him totally. In fact, I really question why the Nobel Committee is allowed to give out peace prizes when they give them out to people like de Klerk and Kissinger. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, I will not bemoan the loss of F.W. de Klerk, and I wish you good night.
Well, that's it tonight, ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades. We've been happy to bring you another show from called Amandla Radio here from CKUT 90.3. And want to thank Kony for involving us in the webinar that got us on top of Trevor Ngwane's book. And Gwen, thank you very much for pulling that all together. And we'll ask you to stay tuned for Jazz Euphorium.